There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
In the spirit of ANU's motto, which is first to know the nature of things, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and waterways, which were never ceded. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today.
I asked the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain. I'm here to make a public statement.
Look, I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I am a fighter and not a quitter.
I don't think I know.
And I want to thank that fellow down under.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Hello there and welcome to another episode of Democracy Sausage from the Australian National University, which comes out each week, as you probably already know. Hopefully you listen each week. Anyway, I'm joined, as always, by Dr. Maria Tafaga, political scientist with the School of Politics and International Relations here at ANU. Hi there, Maria.
Hello, Mark. How are you?
I'm going very well. I'm going better than some. Mike Pezzullo, for example. Perhaps we'll come to his travails in a bit. But let's talk about first Daniel Andrews, because he's quit, obviously, just suddenly as Premier of Victoria. It's not often that you have a state premier going that creates such national news, that it's such a significant story. And it has been covered quite broadly in newspapers around the country and led TV news bulletins, radio news bulletins, because Andrews was such an important figure during the pandemic in particular. We got those daily press conferences and the like. But he really, he's one of the... There's only a few now, only a couple of state leaders. One of them's a territory leader, who were there at the start of the pandemic. So
who are still there now? Yeah,
yeah. And yeah. Andrews was obviously probably the most important one of all of the premiers through that period.
Yeah, Andrews, in a way, if you think about it, actually sort of became leader of the opposition, such as it was, you know, because he offered, I suppose, a different alternative model, and was, I suppose, the most rigorous proponent of it. Due to the
vigorous, I think.
Yeah, vigorous, yeah. I don't want to say zealous, because I think like the specific circumstances of what happened in Victoria kind of required, you know, such a sort of strong response, part of it to do with the weather of Melbourne and so on and so forth, but also like the systemic problems in the Victorian health system and the all of those governance issues that, about sort of being able to share information and to be able to sort of effectively respond, right, which was a big part of why the pandemic also shook out the way it did down there.
I wonder, yeah, it's really interesting to think back on this, because so much of the pandemic is about sort of, you know, long periods of time without specific events or fears that were around at the time that were eventually assuaged by subsequent events, resolved one way or another. And it's easy to forget those early fears. Easy to forget, for example, that when we first knew about this virus, we knew next to nothing about it. We were learning on a sort of a daily basis. The population was taken on a journey
there was a predicted 12% death rate for the global population.
Yeah, and there was no vaccine.
Yeah,
nor was there any prospect in those early days of a vaccine. There was no particularly developed understanding of how it was being transmitted. We didn't really know the survival rate. We knew of, you know, carnage in northern Italy, and we were hearing about it in Manhattan and in lots of other places. So there was a lot of fear around. And, you know, you think back to all that talk about washing your hands and all that eventually came
around. Don't wear a mask. Yeah.
And even that, everything ended up getting politicized, perhaps washing your hands less so than wearing a mask. But turns out wearing your mask was a lot more important than washing your hands.
Mm.
You know, it was a aerosol transmitted disease, and it took us a long time to understand that. And I think that's really important because in that early stage, when decisions had to be made about how governments, how authorities should respond, there was this progressive Labor government sitting there in Victoria, the second largest state, and then there was a Conservative government in power nationally and in New South Wales. And so there was this sort of, you know, kind of, as you described it, Andrews kind of emerges as the opposition leader because he starts saying, well, I don't care what they're doing in Canberra. Exactly. I don't care what they're doing in Sydney. I'm going to protect my population. And so he takes this quite muscular approach. Now, some pretty bad decisions were taken in amongst all of that, and we can come to that. But it is fascinating to think about how the political proclivities, if I can put it like that, of the different leaders shaped how they responded right from the get-go and also how they were perceived right from the get-go.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's actually pretty clear that ideology and ideological concerns definitely had a huge influencing factor on the sort of public policy choices made. In some ways, Morrison was the most chameleon-like, actually, sort of borrowing from all sides of the aisle, and it cost him in the end with his own party because he spent so much money and they thought it was a waste, basically. You know, even though it was probably very good for the political fortunes of that government in the medium term.
Well, we've certainly been paying a price for it in terms of high interest rates and inflation and high interest rates to tame that inflation since. It's not the only factor, but has been a significant factor in all of that.
Yes, you know, we did spend a great deal of money.
$300 billion, right. as Maynard Keynes said, that does rather stimulate an economy.
That's right. Exactly. We are digesting our COVID spending and the war in Ukraine and all the impacts of COVID supply shocks and now the actions of, you know, OPEC basically in constricting fuel prices. So, and don't forget climate change and energy costs, right?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know, it is actually a diabolical kind of mix. And, I mean, like, I think we actually also sort of forget Andrews hurt his back quite severely and was on leave for a few months, right?
Yeah, it was about 12 weeks, I think, and that was March of 21, right? So that was pretty much bang on a year into the sort of height of it, it having really kicked off here in Australia in March of 2020. So in March 21, yeah, he falls down some steps. And at that stage, I wrote about this at the time because it was really fascinating. At that stage, there was this kind of, again, this kind of national shock around Andrews because the whole nation had got to know these premiers, and I think none more so than Andrews, whose press conferences tended to be more interesting than most because of his, I think, very gifted communication style. I think I've seen some negative commentary about him in a range of ways, but I think he's probably the best explainer in politics in this current period, like bar none.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. It was a tremendous communicator, and I think it goes some way to explaining such high degree of compliance over such a long period of time.
Like, yes, the longest lockdowns pretty much around the Democratic
world. Yeah, and if it's not the longest, it's the third or the second.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, absolutely. Like he was an excellent communicator, and I think he had a degree of self-confidence in the sense that I suppose he didn't feel the need to pander to perceptions of what the media might require of him. And I suppose he was also in a position of great strength to do that because he spent all of this time governing in a crisis, real crisis.
Yeah, he had this kind of moral justification for his actions, like as in, I don't care how unpopular this is, or I don't care what Scott Morrison says or Dan Tehan or someone else. What I care about is keeping this community safe. And the trouble with that, and it's a very good thing, I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but the trouble with that is that it can become a justification for just about anything, right? So,
yep.
So, and that became, in a sense, the flashpoint of his either intense popularity, which continued right up until the time that he suddenly pulled the pin, but also his intense unpopularity. You know,
right?
He's a very polarizing figure in that sense.
And I think politics in Victoria is deeply polarized. And I mean, like, we shouldn't forget those actually very scary protests that occurred.
Yeah.
The gallows and
mad cookers and stuff.
Yeah, you know, like it does seem to be the sort of concentration point, I suppose, of phenomena that we've seen in other countries like the convoy movement in Canada or, you know, basically the right in the United States. I think it is interesting his sort of rationale for going, which I think boils down to he always said he would go when he started thinking about it might be time or something like that.
He said he would go the day he started thinking about what life would be like after this job, and he had started thinking about what life would be like.
Yeah.
And so he knew at that moment, well, it's arrived. And but as with everything with Andrews, you know, it was about control. He controlled that message right up to the end. His press conference, his doorstop that he did to announce it yesterday as we record this, was a triumph of kind of clarity, brevity, control. He didn't get emotional from what I could see. He nailed his messages. He looked, as I heard Steve Brack say, former Premier who had also done the same thing, left while he was on top, he looked very relieved and at peace with the decision, which is interesting. It's like these jobs are really hard to get, and mostly that's why really dominant, strong leaders have to be carried out in a box, because they're so hard to get that people can't let go of them, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, he's doing them for 9 years and, you know, like we could – I mean, I think it's kind of interesting to see how the public discourse has changed in just 5 years, because 5 years ago, I think we would have a near 100% cynical view of his reasons for going. Victoria's budget is not in a good state. His government is under pressure. There's lots of inquiries, right? And we're at the point in the sort of accountability cycle where, you know, decisions made will be examined, which is the natural part of any kind of process. But I think it is kind of interesting that there has been a recognition, I suppose, that politics is a bruising business and that politicians are people, even if we only like to admit that for about 35 seconds before going back to thinking of them as, you know, bastards or whatever. And so it will be interesting to see how his legacy, I suppose, is defined over the coming years, because I think his is a legacy that will be sometime in the solidifying because of the complexity around his government.
I think that's right. And I think there are, as you say, sort of probes and inquiries in relation to integrity matters, issues that are still running, and there have been a few that are still unresolved from that pandemic period, and they may be influential on the way he's viewed by history. But I also think Brax is right when he says that whilst the state's indebtedness is high, its projections are quite good, and he has spent an enormous amount on infrastructure where there's a lot of sort of, you know, upfront cost, and that's what's really battered a lot of the balance sheet along with the pandemic itself.
Yep.
And that he has set up, that his idea was that he was setting up the state for the future growth. We know that Melbourne is destined to be a bigger city than Sydney if it's not already, you know, any day, any sort of month now.
Yeah, it's the fastest growing part of Australia right now.
So it's got huge infrastructure demands, and I spend a fair bit of time in Melbourne and I know this, you know, it's definitely a challenge. And so it takes governments that think beyond the current term to actually make some of these decisions. And that may well set the state up for the kinds of growth and to facilitate the kind of lifestyle that Melburnians and Victorians are looking for. Well, you know, we'll see. It's part of the legacy. But I think he'll always be remembered for the strong way he handled the pandemic, and that is not a loaded term. I use it in either way. You know, it's strong as in decisive, but it was. I mean, look at hotel quarantine. That was a debacle, right? The failure of hotel quarantine, the release of the virus, people died as a result of that. You know, it was, and that's never in my mind ever really been. I mean, there was an inquiry, but it seemed to me to be.
Though, to be fair, hotel quarantine seemed to be a problem wherever it was undertaken.
Yeah,
I think there were problems in New South Wales.
There were problems with it, but this had to do with who was in charge of it and who was making
it. Yes, that's right, the security guards and the private contracting.
Yeah.
Yes, which kind of goes to some of the governance issues, I guess, at play.
Yeah, and let's just be clear about that. That was hopeless, right?
Yeah.
I mean, And it was hopeless in the sense it was like a function of sort of neoliberalism in, you know, government decision making. Ultimately, one of the most convincing answers about it was these things happened, that is private security guards, bouncers and so forth, because no one had thought to ask the question. So normal was it to outsource these things. But this was a public health crisis an absolutely deadly pathogen on the loose.
The wider, I guess, implications is actually, you know, people have been sort of complaining or sort of talking about the sort of, I suppose, erosion of the Victorian public health sector, which is often cheated home to Jeff Kennett. But, I mean, wasn't Jeff Kennett voted out of office in like 1999? And it's pretty much been Labor bar 4 years since then. So actually the state of government in Victoria is Labor's doing.
It's, you know, really,
good
that's
or bad.
That's
right?
Really fascinating. Yeah. I noticed Stephen Mayne said that Dan Andrews is the most consequential of all the Victorian premiers. And then I think Stephen Mayne actually worked for Jeff Kennett.
Oh, yeah, okay.
I could be wrong on that, but I think he did. And he said, now, he then predicted that Kennett would probably, you know, challenge that view. He then went on to say, but, you know, Kennett was a slash and burn merchant who, you know, certainly had big consequences for the state, and then Andrews comes along and he's like a builder. But of course there are downsides of both of those things, and we've been talking about it, the huge debt. But the debt, as Brax says, is not as anywhere near as big as it was under Henry Bolte, I think. Premier going way back. Yeah,
yeah, so, yeah, from the 60s.
So they
yeah.
end up with a debt of something in the order of 40% of state GDP. So this debt is less than half that, I think.
Well, I mean, look, if you actually look historically, there's actually been very few truly large L slash and burn Liberal governments. I mean, you know, ultimately they do like spending our money. They just spend it on different stuff.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. Let's take a quick break and come back and talk about some other delightful things.
Hooray!
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
When the wind veered, the smoke was driven backwards, revealing a most amazing scene. Standing columns of fire.
To Be Continued is a new podcast that explores the rich world of lost literary fiction from Australia's past.
It helps you to understand the way in which knowledge is kind of not something that's out there waiting to be discovered, but it's something that you create.
To Be Continued is brought to you by the Australian National University and is available now on your favourite podcast app.
Welcome back. Now, I was going to move on to another topic, but I just want to stick with Daniel Andrews for a minute, because one other thing that occurred to me, you know, occurred to me at the time and occurs to me now, thinking about the pandemic and about how the state government's handled it and so forth, was that it gave politicians, you remember how John Howard, you know, sort of used to talk, it was said at the time, over the gallery's head by going to talkback radio. Subsequent prime ministers have done it with FM radio a bit more, and of course social media has allowed them to do that. What Andrews did through that pandemic, what all the premiers did really with their daily press conferences, but as I say, Andrews's were the most sort of compelling. They were kind of like a witty and willing theatre at times, you know, as people tried the gotcha, and he was every bit up to batting it back at journalists. They often came off worse for wear. But what he did was that he sort of started a relationship with people in their lounge rooms. It's like he realised, I'm talking directly to the voters here for sustained periods, and I'm doing it every day. And it gave the sort of impression of a one-person government almost. I mean, there was the chief health officer and the health minister.
Yes,
and
became a minor celebrity.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And sex symbol, I think, at one stage.
Oh, okay. But, fair enough.
Yeah, I couldn't vouch for that. But yeah, what did you think about that? You know, just the way that Andrews was able to sort of develop this rapport, and it's very much part of the support that he has.
So, you know, there's aspects about it that really remind me of, I guess, the performative skills of politicians from like the pre-television era where, you know, essentially politicians would often do public meetings or you know, literally stand on a soapbox and talk to people, and the crowd would hurl witty asides and sometimes insults, and the politician was expected to be quite deft on their feet, right? And there's lots of great stories from, I suppose, like the sort of first 50 years of Australian history of funny asides and retorts and exchanges, right?
Yeah, Menzies was known for a few of them, wasn't
it? Yeah, exactly. Or George Reed is another one that comes to mind straight away.
I remember one that was attributed to Menzies where someone was sort of yelling out, you know, going on, yeah, tell us all you know, Bob, tell us all you know. And apparently Menzies stopped and he said, I shall, and I shall tell them all you know as well, and it won't take me any longer.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, so things like that, you know. And of course, Dan Andrews wasn't exactly sort of, I suppose, engaging in daily banter, but that point you made about, I suppose, not being cowed by the media and often doing quite well in what is an asymmetric contest, one person against like 30.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that is quite impressive. And I suppose, as you sort of say, like these press conferences was this sort of opportunity that politicians have actually been searching for since the dawn of time.
Yeah, yeah. How to speak to everyone
direct.
That's
right,
yeah.
Exactly. This is sort of eyeballs on the screen. And I suppose
they literally were at home because they were told
to be.
There's
nowhere else to go. And this is where you're getting really important information. Mm. You know, and I suppose it had a kind of concentrating effect. So, you know, it's easier for politicians, I suppose, to talk to segments of people directly, but, you know, we haven't really had, I suppose that was what was interesting about the pandemic. We haven't had, I suppose, such a sort of coherent national conversation for a long time. These press conferences were part of that.
Mm.
And because of the fragmentation in the media, in some ways it is actually a bit more like the 19th century where you've got, you know, yellow journalism, like that's just a fancy way of saying like bullshit on a page.
Yeah.
And, you know, more reputable newspapers.
There's William Randolph Hearst papers.
Yeah,
and so
you know, like people basically just sort of, it's a sort of Wild West, and there being lots of newspapers and lots of ways of obtaining information, and your family being important conduits information and all of that.
Mm.
So, yeah, that's a good point.
And it was fascinating to watch also just quickly the way journalists responded to that. I think not always in positive ways. Journalists realised, because we saw, voters, you know, ordinary citizens got to see press conferences, right? And press conferences mostly were done so that grabs could be used for the evening news. That's obviously changed as we gone into rolling news services and so forth.
Yeah, but most essentially, people don't watch those.
Most people don't, right?
Yeah.
So, and plus they tended to be things where you often couldn't hear the journalist asking the question because the journos themselves weren't mic'd up. But what we had with those daily ones was reverse camera shots and reverse miking so that you could hear the question, you could see the journalist. Some journalists, I think, succumbed to the, you know, the sort of lure of celebrity and, you know, they wanted to land that gotcha question. And Andrews was probably better at most. I remember a very, very grumpy Gladys Berejiklian a few times in New South Wales where she was telling people to stand back, give her more space and so forth. I'm not saying Andrews didn't get grumpy, but he seemed to turn that theatre to his advantage.
Yeah, he seemed to be able to sort of sustain that pressure a bit better. I mean, in some ways I think that was a sort of interesting exercise in, I suppose, the media having its own version of question time, i.e. a bit that people see probably not actually to the benefit of people, what people might think about the actual institution and its job.
Yeah, some of the analysis got a bit unsophisticated, I think. So people who were pro-Dan, as they would have called it, resented any question to him that seemed like it was probing. But that is an entirely important and appropriate thing for journalists to be doing, to be probing the Premier on these things.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can't shy away from the fact that some of the things that happened were the result of the fact that the government literally imprisoned people in their houses for nearly a year cumulatively. Mm. You know,
taped off
exactly.
Playgrounds and this sort of thing.
I mean, Dan Andrews literally did create internally displaced people in our country. Like, do you remember people were camped on the border for weeks, I think over the 2020-2021 Christmas period. Like, that is insane. Like, you know, let's not forget the time when we stopped our own citizens returning.
Yeah, that wasn't his fault though.
No, that wasn't his fault. But, you know, like when you tell these things to foreigners, it's the kind of thing that just blows people's minds. I think what it is really fascinating is that we still don't seem to really make very much of that.
No.
And I just think that is...
Well, the most
that is interesting.
That's interesting. It's also interesting that the most successful of those premiers at closing things off was Mark McGowan in WA.
Who's they had a big desert. That certainly helped.
Yeah, that's true. But the approval rating went through the roof.
Yes,
mind exactly. You, that was on the back of the place being entirely sealed and otherwise life going on as normal.
And definitely more, I suppose, extreme, if we're going to use that kind of language, than Dan Andrews. It's just that it was the cost of implementing McGowan's policies on the actual population was lower because the risks and the actual threat actually playing out in WA was just never reached the same.
You know, the WA
magnitude.
Economy actually, it actually got bigger, I think.
Yeah,
because,
right.
Because a lot of money that would normally be spent by West Australians travelling east for their holidays and various other things was being spent at home. Because they couldn't travel, right?
So basically a mercantilist system that was really working for WA.
Yeah, it was. And, of course, they were still doing well out of royalties and resources, and everything else. So, yeah, it was and McGowan's gone. That only leaves Andrew Barr in the ACT and Anastasia Palaszczuk in Queensland, and she's under a lot of pressure. There's been stories over recent weeks about her stepping down, the pressure on her to step down. She's remaining defined at this stage, but you have to wonder about, you know, whether this will have emboldened those who wanted to go, or perhaps even tripped something in her mind that perhaps she ought to, control the terms of her own departure.
Well, COVID is, I suppose, I guess each year of the pandemic was probably worth three normal years.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Like your age quick is sort of dog years or something.
Like that, right, you know, just because of the sheer... Was the sheer seriousness of it. I mean, I don't want to get into kind of facile comparisons like, well, was it worse than like World War II? Like, I think these are kind of silly kind of comparators, but they're definitely in the same bucket, you know. Like, COVID was clearly an order of magnitude more complex than something like the GFC because it had economic components, social components and biomedical dimensions, not to mention the foreign policy implications.
Yeah,
right?
and it was open ended. We didn't know where it was going to go for a long time, of course, it turned out not to be a race, which was of a great relief to a lot of us. There was a lot of mistakes made, and
it's been a sort of slightly unpleasant memory lane, hasn't it?
It has, but it makes sense to be in this memory lane, not just because of Daniel Andrews, but because the Albanese government has finally announced this inquiry, and it's not
exactly
a royal commission,
and it's hived off many important decisions. So I guess we haven't even talked about school closures and the impact on young people.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the most important, most consequential decisions were made by state governments, and this inquiry has sort of judiciously avoided, even though it's not actually a judicial inquiry, has avoided those unilateral state decisions. So that's interesting. Let's move to another topic, which is of great interest here in Canberra, which is the communications of the head of the Home Affairs Department, often said to be the most powerful bureaucrat in the nation, if it isn't the head of Prime Minister and Cabinet. This being Mike Pezzullo, the head of, as I say, Home Affairs Department, which is now a mega department. And we now know, as a result of a whole lot of encrypted messages that have been made public, that he was conducting a pretty interesting sort of dialogue with a senior Liberal Party operative. And
yes, one perhaps not quite compatible with our sort of traditional notions of a Westminster Mandarin.
Yes. They seem to lack the neutrality that we would normally expect.
Yes.
Are we naive about that, though?
Look, I think on one level, yes, but I think there's a nice sort of distinction that I quite like in the literature, which sort of likes to think of things as all political and apolitical. So, you know, the apolitical bureaucrat is someone who really isn't involved in politics at all, and an all political bureaucrat is someone who is sensitive to political realities and is able to maintain, I suppose, their role as a keeper of continuity, advice, but cognizant of, I suppose, the political realities. So they're not going to sort of suggest, I guess, what they think might be the best policy solution, but they'll suggest perhaps the best one that was most likely to sort of fit with the political reality of the time. And
like
robo
debt, for example.
So for example, like, you know, look, bureaucrats are there to serve the government of the day. And the problem with politicization is not that bureaucrats don't take into politics into account. Really good and effective bureaucrats do. They understand the sort of political pressures that a minister is under, but they say no when it's illegal at the most basic level.
Like
right?
with robo-debt, yes.
Precisely. Or they say no when it's a bad idea because we tried that before and it didn't work or for whatever. Or they sort
and
of
Pizzullo,
say,
to his credit, does have a record of having said no at certain things that would have been illegal or unethical.
Yes, and there's certainly some behaviours which I'm sure other bureaucrats around, like empire building, for example, like trying to accrue power in a bureaucracy, like that is a well documented phenomena, right? You know,
yes, minister is based on
indeed,
a lot of this, and we, you know, and as you say,
indeed.
there are those, if you divide the sort of apolitical and the all political,
exactly.
The all political tend to be the ones. More senior, right?
Yes.
You want
to
stay apolitical, you know, you can do that, but you do need to understand the system within which you are working and the forces that are at play.
That's right.
Within that system and how that will shape policy and so forth.
That's right. And there are many things that have emerged in these text messages that, you know, I just think are hard to view in a more neutral light, I suppose. Is
oh yeah,
maybe
I, yes.
Know.
I don't want. I don't. I
yeah,
don't
without,
want to sort of suggest
yeah.
that these are normal for other bureaucrats.
No, they're not.
That's
you know.
What makes these interesting. They
yeah.
are very, very
exactly.
political, and they're sort of overtly so. And it was. I don't think it's all that surprising that some senior bureaucrats. I think if we knew the communications of other senior bureaucrats, we'd probably find some other examples of senior bureaucrats saying to their ministers. You know, such and such is on the make here, and they're going to try and take your portfolio, or you know, they may have views about this or that other department or policy coming from AGs instead of from another department or whatever. But this is an order of magnitude
exactly.
different. This is a much more salient intervention
and repeated. From the looks
yeah.
of it, right? And I think that's the point there. So I sort of try to emphasize two points. It's like, yeah, you know, you asked me if we are being a bit naive about this. And I think sometimes we probably are a little bit naive about, I suppose, the slippage in a system like the Westminster system, which at the end of the day is actually really based on conventions. And that is actually why the things like public sector values and the sort of norms and the reinforcement and reproduction of these norms as being essentially there to serve the Australian public through the government as opposed to the government only is really important, but that actually requires a great deal from public servants. And if that whole system isn't self-reinforcing a set of values and norms and that's constantly being modelled and politicians aren't really putting the screws on that, right? And I think we have seen several examples where that pressure coming from political elites is you know, I don't think helpful, I suppose, would be the neutral way to say it. And there are certainly things in the Pizzullo messengers that are sort of kind of more benign or more, I suppose, sort of part of the sort of what you might expect.
Yeah, that sort of push and pull or whatever,
Indeed, part of a robust dialogue. And then there are some things that are, you know, clearly requiring investigation at the
well,
very
let's,
least.
Let's be clear. I mean, you know, saying we need a right winger in this portfolio, running down possible cabinet ministers.
Yes, quite clearly on the other side of that line.
Yeah. Insisting that the then head of the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet was not up to the job and was insecure. And by the way, if should the Prime Minister, with whom
need
I know
finisher.
You're close, need a finisher to you know, I've never coveted the job, but I'll just, I'd respond to that call. I mean, there was clear coat trailing going on. And it
was clearly a bit two-way, right? Like they're both helping, like there was that sort of request to give some advice to the then Prime Minister around retaining someone in an acting role in order that they could attend a specific meeting, you know.
So
it's definitely not the waddle of Westminster that we would expect textbook.
No, that's right. Now, look, we've only got a few minutes left, but let's just have a quick sort of check-in on the health of the voice as far as we can determine it, which is not good. If you are a yes voter and if you listen to this podcast, there's a reasonably good chance you are because, you know, the polls are fairly consistent, and that's the thing, I guess, that's most worrying. It's not just that the yes vote support for the change has slumped, but this is fairly consistent across just about every survey. And so it's in the somewhere, you know, mid to low 40 range. Some polls have it even lower than that. And, you know, it started out last year, support for this idea was in the mid 60 range.
Yeah, which is the same level of support that gay marriage ultimately achieved.
Yeah, 62%, yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, we know about the double hurdle, you know, the requirement for a majority of votes nationally and also a majority in four of the six states. That's looking very hard. I wonder, we all need to be, I guess, mindful of not assuming the result before it happens. But I've been frustrated watching some elements of the campaign. I thought the government allowed the choice that essentially allowed the proposition to be defined by the no case really for months without really doing much. Or let me put it more broadly, the yes case, the yes advocates, which included the government and others, seemed to just have this working assumption that they were, you know, they were in a strong position from the beginning. And it's been eroded. It's been cut from underneath by all kinds of wild and wacky, you know, untruths and exaggerations and elaborations and associations. You know, just as I've described it somewhere, it's like a handful of gravel, you know, it will hit something.
Yeah. I mean, I think the no case has been very successful in doing effectively two things, sort of saying, well, if you don't know, vote no, and then providing so much confusing noise that it increases the probability that the average citizen who is less inclined to really engage with this question will be confused and not know.
If you're confused, your tendency is to go with the status quo,
which requires little effort and is low risk from that person's standpoint. I mean, I think one of the sort of frustrating, I suppose, dimensions of the yes campaign is, and I don't know, maybe this is just a very political scientist thing to sort of say, but I just feel like the debate around the voice has not really been future focused enough, if that makes sense. Like, we sort of touched on this last week. It actually seems like there are many reasons to vote yes, just as there may be many reasons to vote no, though I haven't really thought through every single one on the no side. But there are many reasons to vote yes, and a lot of the ones that have been really put forward are sort of more symbolic based arguments around completing the national project, coming to terms with Australia's history, and righting a wrong and that kind of stuff. And I think one of the issues around that is it's very backward looking, and I think it also takes us and really kind of plays into the no's hands, which is just sort of reheated all of this stuff from the 90s. And I think plays to a cohort of people who've actually heard all of this stuff before 20 years ago, 30 years ago, And it reinforces that frame, like, oh, the white elites in Canberra are lecturing me again and I'm just going to shut down. Mm. And I think what is actually kind of important about The Voice, and it's not like it hasn't been discussed, but it's often only just discussed as an advisory body. But actually, the word is representations, and The Voice has sort of three dimensions if you think about it from an analytical perspective. One is advice, right? That makes sense. And I think we kind of understand what that is. The other side of that relates to accountability, and that is because it's actually able to make representations. So it can offer advice, raise issues, be educative, but it can also offer a sustained critique, right? Either of government or, from the case, the perspective of conservative no voters, Indigenous organisations that are spending my money. And the third pillar of it, which is the bit where it's embedded in the Constitution, giving it that protection from the Constitution, is consistency. And that is actually the multiplier effect that we need for the advice and the accountability mechanism to work well.
Yeah.
Because we have had advisory bodies and we have had accountability functions, but they have never been permanent and they have never been embedded.
They've never been elevated to that status of permanence.
Precisely.
Yes, I agree.
And giving it that protection in the Constitution does a couple of things, right? Like one, it is just simply giving it security and consistency, but it also gives it a great deal of legitimacy, because most of these advisory bodies have actually just been white elites in governments selecting their advisors. And so it doesn't have the same degree of legitimacy as representatives from a local community filtering up information, right? Raising issues, giving advice, but also pointing out major kind of problems and offering a sustained critique, whether that is how the federal government is choosing to allocate funds, or what federal departments are doing, or what Aboriginal organisations funded by the federal government are doing on the ground, you know.
Yeah.
And the final thing about consistency is that it allows for what we would call institutionalization. And if an institution such as A Voice is successful and seen to fulfill its function of representation and is seen to be given results, then it is actually, for those progressive no voters out there, actually far more likely to accrue more powers and far more likely to be persuasive and far more likely to create the discourses that progressive no voters actually want to see, right? Rather than what is currently a very modest and definitely conservative, absolutely within parliamentary legitimacy frame. It will never expand beyond parliamentary legitimacy because literally it says the parliament's in charge. And
yes, that's what the amendment would say.
Yeah. And for like those who are worried that it will like, you know, grow out of control and like the UN will take over the Australian government. Well, the only way that's going to happen is if the Australian Parliament is down and right and cool with reforming the Constitution in many different ways to allow the UN to run our government.
Yeah, yeah, precisely. It nonetheless, it has been an unedifying process watching this kind of get eroded by a lot of, as you say, noise and dust and irrelevancies and fears that have been dredged up of land being taken. I mean, Noel Pearson makes the point that not one inch of Australian land was lost to anyone from Wick or Mabo, those decisions. He said they got the balance right, and this is the perfect balance here in the Constitution, balancing the British common law tradition and our parliamentary system that has arrived from England, and therefore the constitutionality of that, balancing that with 65 millennia of prior occupation, and doing so in a way that is a perfect accommodation of those two things. And I think he makes
a very
good point. It is
a very generous offer.
It is. And he also makes the point, going to the other element of your argument there about the practical side of it. You know, he uses the example of rheumatoid heart disease, which he says is still a problem in Cape York. He said this at the press club. The member, the federal member, has been there for 27 years, I think. And this two people, young people mostly, people in their 20s or 30s, sometimes younger, are dying from rheumatoid heart disease, two a week.
Exactly.
And the member had never in that time raised it in the federal parliament. I mean, if you know, can you think of a more graphic example of issues that are effectively marginalised, sidelined?
Exactly. And I think it actually makes there's another really important point, because one of the arguments you hear is that, there are lots of Indigenous people elected to Parliament through parties, but you know, we were just talking about whether or not we were being naive, and I mean, to be blunt, they are elected on a party label. Party discipline is an overwhelming force in our politics.
Yeah.
That is actually why,
to represent a geographical area usually,
right,
as well.
Yeah. That's right. And we actually see this as it's not just Indigenous Australians who were in Parliament who face the sort of barrier of having to navigate representing their people and, you know, essentially operating within a political party. You know, it's actually any minority faces this dilemma, and it is reflected in the way that policy change for minority groups is ground out over usually a decade.
Mm.
And that's just the sort of reality of it. Like, to give you another example of how a voice might really make a difference. So in Megan Davis was part of a review of the New South Wales child protection system, and one of the things they sort of found, which was really shocking, was a non-trivial number of cases in which simply the wrong paperwork is filed about a different child and a different family in court, which then authorises a removal of a child from a family. And the reality of having to engage the bureaucracy in a battle to win back your kid when you are from a lower social capital community is overwhelming. And so only a few people are going to be able to sustain the resources required. And the way a lot of these cases have eventually come to light is via the media, which is not a consistent accountability mechanism, but you know, a set of representatives that can kind of channel that kind of accountability concerns upwards has a far better chance of not only addressing individual terrible decisions, but also being able to not only push for systemic changes, but to actually question governments on their ability to carry them through. We love royal commissions in this country, but actually the changes that come from them are in the implementation phase. They are ground out over the next 5 years.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, Noel Pearson described the change at the press club as modest but profound, and I think that's a really good description of it. And yet, it's also sort of encapsulates part of the problem. It's very difficult to explain that. He says that it's modest, but it will get better results in the way that you were just talking about. And he says, listening, it isn't everything, but it's a precondition for any success. And I think that's very likely to be true as well. So.
There's a lot of evidence for it.
I think if a lot more people could listen to his address at the press club, and perhaps we'll be talking to him soon on Democracy Sausage. We'll hope that comes about. But if people could look at that address at the National Press Club, have a listen to what he had to say, how he responded to the questions, I think it was very, very persuasive, and I just wish more people would take the time to do that. Speaking of time, we're out of it. Thanks, Maria.
Thanks, Mark.
Great to chat.
As always.
And that's Democracy Sausage for this week. As I've told you before, no doubt you can get in touch with us on our email address, democracysausage@anu.edu.au. Until next week, it's bye from us.
Bye.